Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats Podcast. Every week, we'll find out just what the special sauce is of some of the leading lights of our cultural fabric, both food folks and non-food folks alike.
You're a fat fuck, Ed Levine.
Today, we're going to talk to comedian and actress Susie Essman, who we just figured out you and I have known each other almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years.
That's crazy.
It means we're really old, Ed.
So tell us something surprising about yourself. Like, what's something that no one would possibly believe about Susie Essman?
That I'm really nice.
You mean that you don't curse at everyone you walk by on the street?
I see, you know, people come up to me in the street and I see that they're visibly disappointed when I'm kind and generous and gracious and I'm not yelling and screaming. Their jaw drops and I see tremendous disappointment on their face.
That's hilarious. They want you to curse at them.
Yes. Yes.
And they or they want to be walking by you while you're cursing at whoever you're walking with.
Exactly.
That's hilarious.
But something surprising. I love to cook.
You do?
Yes. I love to cook.
And was that something that was always true?
No.
Was it true when you met Jimmy?
Well, it was true when I redid my kitchen, which was recent. You know, we moved to this great house upstate New York, and we redid the kitchen. We had electric because we have no natural gas, and we finally put in propane and, you know, got a gas stove, which is a completely different world, as you know. And I started cooking. And started really getting creative with it and enjoying it. And I have people over and I love feeding them. And it was, you know, I was single for years in Manhattan. I live, as you know, on the Upper West Side. So I was always equidistant between Zabar's, Citarella, and Fairway, some of the best prepared food you could possibly get. And I was single. So I wasn't cooking.
Right. You were getting something on the way to something else.
Exactly. Why would I cook? And then when I first met Jimmy, my husband, which was almost 12 years ago, and he had these four children, and he would cook, you know, like chicken fingers, just macaroni and cheese, and just crap that he cooked. And I never ate that way. I was always, you know, a really healthy eater. And as you know, I was a vegetarian for 35 years, no longer. But then I started, you know, cooking a little bit more for the kids and cooking a lot of vegetables, which I love. And now I'm just like nonstop cooking.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And do you feel like there's a relationship between the craft of cooking and the craft of comedy?
Well, timing. They both require timing. They both require a lot of... I'm an improvised cook. I'm not a recipe follower. You know, I'll look at a recipe and just get an idea, but then it's completely improvised. So they're both, the way I work, they're both a lot of improvisation. They both bring people pleasure. And they're both creative endeavors.
Yes, they're creative endeavors. They're craft with a dollop of art mixed in, right?
Yeah, I mean, I get great pleasure from people loving my cooking. I also get great pleasure from making people laugh. Hopefully they're not laughing at my cooking.
That's awesome. So what was your food life like growing up in Mount Vernon? Your dad was a doctor.
Right.
And your mom was a Russian professor.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, like, was your mom making chicken Kiev
yes.
at the same time your dad was going, this isn't good for you?
No, he was not. Most doctors know nothing about nutrition. That's just a fact. Maybe it's different now, but I don't think much. My dad was always overweight. My mother had her Russian specialties that she made that her mother taught her, beef stroganoff, chicken Kiev, borscht, a Russian borscht that she had. Her secret recipe was that she would use V8 juice in the borscht. She wasn't a great cook, but she had her couple of things. And I was kind of particular. I would only eat filet mignon, for example. So she would wait till filet mignon went on sale, and she would buy it for me. But whatever I told her I liked, then I was inundated with forever. Which, like, I remember once telling her I liked bologna. I had a bologna sandwich every day for lunch for like 3 years until I wanted to kill myself, you know.
But so you should never tell your mom what you like.
I know. Well, you know, but when I think back on her, and I was one of four, she had four kids, we had dinner every night. She made dinner every night for a family of six, and then there was always friends there. So it was maybe 8 or 10. I mean, they all did in that generation,
so
I guess.
So how ironic is it that all those years later, you meet Jimmy,
yeah,
four children, you're cooking for six.
Yeah, except it's different now. Now, I mean, I assume that you were the same. When we were kids, we never went out to eat.
No.
Never.
I mean, we went to the Chinese restaurant.
On Sundays, maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Or on Thursdays when my dad would work late, we would sometimes get pizza. But that was it.
Same with us.
My kids were brought up eating out. You know, my kids were brought up eating out all the time. We didn't have dinner. It was a different kind of thing than how I was brought up. And I think it's a problem, actually, because now that they're adults living on their own, they're used to eating out all the time. They don't realize how expensive it is.
Yes, and that gateway to cooking is sometimes hard to find, isn't it, for, like, your kids?
Well, they're all foodies. They drove me crazy by the only channel that was ever on in my house was the Food Channel. It was Food Network or the Cooking Channel. And they all love to cook.
That's amazing.
Love to cook, and they all love to watch food shows. That's their favorite thing to watch. I shouldn't complain about that. It would just drive me crazy. You know how many times I had to watch Ina, what's her face name?
Ina Garten.
Yeah, exactly. I think there was something about it that was soothing to them.
Yes, it is.
In the same way that I watched TCM, like,
Ina Garten to them was like the accommodating, friendly aunt.
Right.
That they might have never had or wanted to have or wanted to be present.
And there was something about watching the creation of a meal that was extremely soothing to them. It was very mellow for them to always have the Cooking Channel on, the Food Network on in the background.
It grounded them, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And it sort of was in direct contrast to what their hormones were telling
them
to do.
Exactly, which was not pretty. But, you know, when I first met them, I was still a vegetarian. Did I ever tell you how I stopped being a vegetarian?
No, I was going to get to that. I want to hear this.
Okay, so I think it was about 2.5-3 years ago. It was around then. And I got, and Jimmy, my husband, he's a meat and potatoes kind of guy. And I got him a Bacon of the Month Club for his birthday.
Oh, I know that. From the Grateful Palate.
I don't remember
Zingerman's,
what it was from.
One of the two.
It was Zingerman's.
Yeah.
It was from Zingerman's. Because, you know, you run out of stuff to get. It's like you're constantly trying to come up with new gift ideas. So I got him the Bacon of the Month Club. And I was I ate fish. But no chicken, no beef, not even, I was very careful in my soups to make sure it wasn't chicken stock. 35 years. Ask Jeffrey Steingarten.
We'll get to that in a second.
He had contempt for me, for my vegetarianism. So Jimmy's making the bacon, and I smell the bacon. And you know what bacon, I mean, is there any better odor than bacon?
Eau de Bacon is probably the finest cologne in the history of mankind.
Exactly. So I'm smelling the bacon, and suddenly I'm thinking, why am I not eating this?
Bacon was really your gateway food.
It was. What was I thinking all these years that I was not? It smelled amazing, and I took a bite. And then that was it. That was it. And I was in a better mood. I was in a way better mood after I started. My body, I think, needed the iron or the meat or something. My whole personality changed
after
I started eating meat. I swear to you, it's true. You could ask my husband.
You know
next
why?
Time you
because
run
like when you eat vegetables, there's only vegetables. Even we have fantastic vegetarian recipes on the site, and Kenji eats
right.
a lot of vegetables and. But there's just...
I still eat a lot of vegetables.
Yeah.
I love vegetables.
It doesn't mean that you have to neglect vegetables. It just means that there's a certain place in your life
Ed,
that
I will
meat...
never eat tofu again. I'm repulsed by tofu. I have eaten so much tofu, it's coming out of my fucking ears, okay? I am never eating tofu again. Or seitan.
Seitan to me is so aptly named.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And you know, when I was a vegetarian, it wasn't really, it wasn't moral, because I always had a leather jacket. You know, it was a visceral kind of aesthetic thing where, you know, somebody wouldn't eat dog, for example. You know, that's how it felt to me to eat an animal, a cow or a lamb or a pig. That's how it felt to me. I would somehow that's gone.
Right.
And I still like to eat, you know, organic and happily raised.
Local and all that.
And I do feel that if the animal is happily raised and running around on the farm and then they're slaughtered, they had a good life.
Mm-hmm. And so, it's important.
Yeah.
And it is. It's funny that I'm the same way. It's like, it's weird that we've decided that that's important to us, that the animal was happy.
Yeah.
Right? Because before we were really, are our children happy?
Right.
You know, it's like, are we happy?
It might be hypocritical. I don't know.
No, I think it's not. I think it's something that the culture has come to embrace.
Yeah.
The idea
ethically
treatment. Raised right. animals that we eat.
And the other, I mean, there are chemical issues also. I really do think that stress hormones and things like that get into the animal when they're poorly treated. And I love animals. I don't want them to be horribly treated the way that, you know, the Upton Sinclair.
You know, we did a television show, I think almost 20 years ago,
yeah.
together with Jeffrey Steingarten.
Right.
So a more unlikely trio.
Right.
One could not imagine, right? Susie Essman, Jeffrey Steingarten, and me. How did we come to do that television
show? Well, I was
show?
Hosting a nightly show on the Metro Channel, which was an MSG affiliate, Madison Square Garden Network. And it was every night we did something else. And once a week, it was the New York Eats. It was about food. And Jeffrey, and it was live. It was live television. I don't know if you recall
yes,
that.
Yes, our first shows were live.
Yeah, they were all live. The whole thing was live. I had New York Pets one night, and they would be like animals all over, and then the Eats.
So you
then
would be one of the channel hosts.
Yeah, I was one of the channel hosts. And Jeffrey, oh my God, he had such contempt for my vegetarianism. Such utter and complete contempt for it. Like he just, you know, it's ridiculous.
And Jeffrey, of course, being Jeffrey, does not hide his contempt
no,
well.
No. I mean, I could handle it. I was a big girl. I handled
no,
it.
No, you
I think.
Handled
it. But it was fun.
You handled it. We had the greatest time.
Fun.
When I tell people we did that show, they were always like, wow, how did that come together? I think it was Ron Fried, the executive producer's
Fried.
Idea,
yes.
right?
It was like, yeah. Let's... And that was before Curb. That was before I did any of that. And I was a working comedian, and that was a good gig for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's hard to be a working comedian
yes,
and
indeed.
Make a living, right?
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your path to doing what you love, which is making people laugh, and that it's not, you know, it's not what people see on TV when they see, you know, Jerry Seinfeld. It's like, oh, yeah, this guy, he just appeared on our TV and
yeah.
he's making a lot of money and has the most popular television. That's not a comedian's life.
No, and Jerry, I mean, you bring Jerry up. Jerry was a road warrior before he did Seinfeld. I mean, all of the people who, not all, but generally I found that most of the people who had successful sitcoms or television careers had been around a long, long time.
They had paid their dues.
Yeah, whether it was Jerry or Ray Romano or Jay Leno or Roseanne or Paul Reiser, if I'm mad about you. I mean,
Right, or even the current ones like Louis C.K. or whatever.
Louis and I started together. He was a couple of years after me. I've been doing this summer it'll be 32 years that I've been doing stand-up. You know, we all started in New York together. It was Louis and me. Years ago, there was a show called Caroline's Comedy Hour. There was a period of time in the 90s, I guess, when it was constant stand-up comedy shows on TV. You remember, it was the Evening at the
yeah.
Improv, and VH1 had one. Colin Quinn was the host of Caroline's Comedy Hour, and this was the writing staff. It was Jon Stewart, me, Louis C.K., and Dave Attell.
Wow.
That was the writing staff for Caroline's Comedy Hour.
That's incredible.
We just wrote sketches, and Colin also was on the staff. But, you know, when we started in the 80s, in the mid-80s, comedy was just explosive in New York City. And there was a million clubs, and there was not that many of us. So the most important thing for a comedian is stage time. That's the only way you get good.
And that's where the craft comes in.
Exactly. And when I started, it was those guys. It was Chris Rock. It was Joy Behar. It was, you know, we all kind of came up together.
But you weren't doing it to make money. You just needed the time, right? Because the time didn't equal money.
No, you got what was called cab fare, which was $7. You would go do a set, and it was on the weekends you get money. You get $50 a set, some places,
right.
30 to 50. And what I used to do is run around from club to club on a weekend so I could make a few $100 and make my rent. You know,
wow.
I do 6, 7, 8 shows a night. And you would try to time it by which clubs served food. You know, that was like a whole thing of where they fed you. You know, so we would, Gilbert Gottfried, we would all be running around, you know, set to set and just working on our craft. And then the end of the night, you'd end up, usually I used to end up the end of the night at the comic strip, which was on 82nd and 2nd. And then, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, you'd all go to the diner.
Right.
And you talk about your material.
Wow.
We'd all talk about the sets we had that night. Or
and
our material.
You guys would probably critique each other's material
if
you heard of them.
Exactly. We'd all be, you know, that's, and it was, I was young then. It was great. You know, it was a tremendous sense of community. I don't know if it's still like that in the clubs. I think there's so many more comedians now.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all of us. I mean, you look at these people who are so wildly, way more successful than I am, whether it's, you know, Adam Sandler or Chris Rock or Jon Stewart. We were all about the material and the work. None of us were like, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to get my own show. You know, none of us were like that. Now, Jerry was already, you know, up there. You know, even though, you know, we're similar ages, he started much younger.
Right. And he was doing auditorium stand-up.
Correct.
And all that.
And he still worked clubs, but he was already a very well-established comic. Other person I met in those days was Larry David, who was a stand-up comic. And Larry was notorious for his idiosyncratic way of performing. You know, Larry would do things like get on stage, look at the audience, and just say, never mind, and just walk off.
That would be the whole set.
Yeah, yeah. Or he would get, I remember one night he was doing some bit. We would all the comedians, he was what was known as a comedian's comedian. All the comedians would come on in the room to watch Larry because his material was brilliant. You know, he was such a brilliant writer, but he didn't always connect. He didn't always connect to an audience. And if one person looked at their watch, that was it. He was even if everybody else was laughing. One night I remember something bizarre. He was doing some bit about a bungalow colony or something, and somebody in the audience said, "What's a bungalow?" That was it. That set him off. And he started a fight with the person. He would end up having fights with people out at the bar. You know, it was always fun to watch
Larry.
So what's
funny is, from what you're saying, those kinds of exchanges became the heart of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, the heart of Seinfeld first. You know, I mean, because George Costanza was really based on Larry. And as Jason Alexander, who played George, as we know, will tell the story in the beginning of Seinfeld, he would say, look at the script. He would say, this is ridiculous. This would never happen to a person. And Larry would say, it happened to me. It happened to me. It was all true. And then a lot of Larry's bits became episodes of Seinfeld.
And so when he decided to do Curb,
yeah.
Were the scripts really as improvised as people say?
Yes. How Curb came about was he was doing a special for HBO about him doing an HBO special. And Jeff Garlin, who plays my husband, he developed the concept with Larry and he played his manager. And Jeff's wife was not in the special. And in the middle of the special, they thought, you know, this could really be a great TV series. And HBO agreed. And I think he had been auditioning people for Jeff's wife. And then he saw me do the Jerry Stiller roast, the Friars roast for Jerry Stiller that aired on Comedy Central. And it was like, and I hadn't seen him in years, you know.
Ben Stiller's father.
Yes, Ben Stiller's father. Jerry, who was also on Seinfeld and then King of Queens. And so he saw me do that special and it was just like, I think, a light bulb moment for him where he thought, oh, Susie should play the part. So it was all, you know, to me, my career has always been about showing up, showing up, showing up. You just keep on showing up and just keep on like a shark, just moving forward. And that roast the Friars Club fought for me to be on that roast because Comedy Central didn't want me on that roast. They turned me down. And the Friars Club, where I had done so much, because they do a lot of charity work, I'd done so many benefits for them, never getting paid, but just, you know, keep. And I had made my bones with the old Starkers who did not think women were funny. You know, your Alan Kings and these guys, you know, did not think women were funny. And I had made my bones with them, and they liked me. They saw that I was funny, and they fought for me to be on that roast. And I think Comedy Central probably figured, oh, we'll always cut her out. But they didn't, because I killed. And Larry saw that. This was 1999. Larry saw that, called me up one day. I remember this phone call so vividly. He was like, Susie, hi, it's LD. And I was like, oh, hi, I haven't spoken to you in 10 years. What's up? And he was like, I have this new show I'm doing on HBO. I want you to play Jeff Garlin's wife. And I said, well, what's the character? Never mind. Don't worry about it. You could do it. And I said, well, send me a script. There's no script. And then I was like, all right, well, what's the money? There's no money. You're going to have to fly yourself out and put yourself up. Because I lived in New York, as you know, always. And I was like, well, I don't mind working for day scale, but I'm not flying my, it's not going to cost me money. So then they came up with some money and they flew me out coach and put me in some flea bag hotel in Venice. And we did it. I mean, and you know, 8 seasons later.
Wow.
But yet no script. There is no script. There's an outline that will have maybe 7 pages and each paragraph will be what happens in each scene, but there's no dialogue written at all.
Got
all
it.
Of that is improvised.
Got it.
Which is really an amazingly fun way to work.
But not scary to you.
No, I'm a comedian. There would be certain actresses and actors that would come on that were very scared of improvising. I remember Anne Bancroft, who's a brilliant actress, and of course her husband is one of the greatest improvisers ever,
Mel Brooks.
But she kept on saying aloud, give me the lines. Tell me what you want me to say. You know, so it's interesting. I mean,
yeah.
But for a comedian, especially a comedian that works the way I do on stage, which is everything spontaneous and improvised, it's not scary at all. What's scary to me is when I have to memorize lines.
Yeah. So where do you draw inspiration from? What do you grab onto?
Life. I don't really do politics or topical. Unless it's something that just strikes me in the moment. Election years, usually something comes up. Just life. I mean, look, as you know, because you knew me before I met my husband, Jimmy, I acquired these 4 children like they were on sale and then brought them up, essentially.
Yes. And that could have been a sitcom in and of itself.
I did a pilot for CBS based on my life of bringing up these kids. It didn't go, nor should it have. It wasn't very good. But so now I have huge hunks of material about bringing up teenagers. I have huge hunks of material about being married. I didn't get married until I was 53 years old. You know, I mean, I was old.
Right.
What else? You know, my mother's going to be 90 in a couple of weeks. The aging parents and the dealing with whatever
is
fodder.
Fodder for your act.
Yeah.
What's the scariest part about it?
Stand up?
Yeah.
You know, it's all scary to me. There's a few things that are really scary to me. One is that I'm always afraid that it's just going to leave me. My ability to be funny. I'm backstage and I'll always say to Jimmy, and you know, this is what I do before I go on. I tell him everything wrong with him. That's my warm up before I go on stage.
It's almost like you're in labor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Last week you said this and I knew you meant that. But I become an insane woman. But I always backstage, I'll say to him, I have no funniness in me. I'm not funny. I have no funniness in me. I don't think it's ever happened in 32 years that I've gotten on stage and it's been gone. But that's my fear, that the muse will go. Part of that is by the way that I work, because I don't have a beginning, middle, and end. I mean, I have an act, I have material, but I never know what I'm going to do before I get on stage, because I like it to be spontaneous and I like to feel the room. And you know, that's another. It's like you know, these cooking shows where they just give the chefs the ingredients. This is your ingredients, and it's, you know, pork rinds and kale or whatever, and you have to make something. That's kind of how it feels to me when I get on stage, where the audience is my ingredients, and wherever I'm at emotionally is combined with that. And then I just like to, you know, make my stew.
Wow.
I like to see what I'm going to do and where I'm going to go, and I never plan it. Usually I'll have my opening line planned, just because if I don't have that, I'm nuts. But I never have it planned, so it's all scary.
And do you? I guess if you're that anxious, you probably don't eat before you go on.
No, I need to have some protein, and I need to eat, light. I need to eat light a couple of hours before I go on. I don't like to feel full and heavy when I'm on stage. I don't like anything that's going to repeat itself while I'm on stage. I used to eat sushi when I was a vegetarian. That would be my thing, to have sushi. I don't eat sushi anymore.
But are you ravenous afterwards?
Afterwards, I am ravenous, and I have to have alcohol.
So you're thirsty too.
I'm thirsty, yes. I have to have a drink when I come off. Never before.
Right.
And I grew up in a time when, a lot of comics were drinking before they went on, doing coke before they went on, getting high in any way, shape. I never could do that.
But you needed that drink afterwards.
After, yes.
Just to bring you down, right?
Yeah, because the adrenaline is so intense.
Right.
It's just
and even
so
though
intense.
It's only like 20 minutes or however long.
Well, when I headline, it's an hour 15.
Wow.
And I come off stage exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
I come off stage. When I'm headlining, I'm exhausted. And part of that is because of the way I work. And then I like to eat and drink.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to Curve for a second. Was it fun to curse and abuse Jeff Garlin so often, or did you just regard it as a role?
Well, there's two answers to that. Doing Curve was for all of us completely joyful. We had so much fun doing it. The first season, there was an episode called The Wire where Jeff brings a fresh air fun kid into our house and he robs us blind. And that's the first real Susie Green scene where she's screaming and yelling and cursing. And the direction Larry gave me for that scene, and this is the only direction he's ever given me. We never discussed my character. I came up with how crazy outfits and, his direction was rip Jeff a new asshole. So I was like, I thought, okay, I've been in relationships before. I could do this. So I starred in on him, and Larry's pulling me aside. Do more. Larry Charles directed that episode, by the way. And he's like, go further. You're not going far enough. They did it again. It's a couple of takes. Go further. Finally, he pulled me aside, and he said, make fun of Jeff's fat. Call him a fat fuck, fat bastard, something like that. And I was like, Larry, I don't want to do that. Jeff has an eating problem. He's fat and he's my friend and it's going to hurt his feelings. And I felt bad about it. I didn't want to do it. And Larry says, just do it. Just do it. He knows you're just acting. Just do it. Just go for it. Well, I did. And the rest, the cat was out of the bag. The genie was out of the bottle. But people ask Jeff all the time, do you feel bad when Susie says that to you? And he always responds, Susie Essman doesn't treat me that way. It's her character that treats my character that way. I never call Jeff a fat fuck. I don't walk on the set and say, hey, fatty. I don't do that. I do sometimes feel bad when I'm, I don't like to pick on people's appearance. Let me just say this about Susie Green. All her rage is almost always justified. They're always doing something to her to provoke it. Larry steals her kid's
dog,
gets them kicked out of the country club, whatever. He's provoking her. Or Jeff's cheating on her all the time. But I never like to make fun of people's appearance. But for some reason, it clicked and I'm known for it.
So how did being on that show change both your everyday walking around life and your work life?
Well, it changed my work life in major ways because every comedian, when I was talking about the old days at Catch a Rising Star, and they were all showcase clubs and audiences would come to see a lineup and you were part, there was usually four or five comics and an MC on a lineup and they weren't there to see me. They were there to see comedy. And so you always have to, you don't know what the audience is going to be. They might like you, they might not. You always have to win them over. Once you're on television and you could draw your audience, it becomes, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, there's tremendous expectation, so it becomes scarier because you have to deliver, and they're paying a lot of money to see you. On the other hand, it's fantastic because they're there to see me. They know what they're getting. I don't have to win them over. I've got them already. So it allows me creatively to just go wherever I want and be as outrageous as I want to be.
And so it's emancipating.
It's fantastic. And I don't have to prove anything. When you're doing these other clubs, you're always fighting for stage time. But once you start drawing your audience, It's just, it's what every comic wants, is to draw their audience. It's why I want Larry to get back to do stand-up, because now he would draw an audience and they'd be there to see him and they'd be totally into that Larry head, and he wouldn't have that problem with the bungalow.
So now we're going to get to some sort of desert island food questions that we always ask. Tell me what would be in your desert island fridge.
Potato chips, French fries, and bacon.
A woman after my own heart.
And, you know, but it has to be really good. It can't be soggy. It's got to be really good
bad
French fries.
Bad frozen French fries.
No, ugh, not Orida or whatever that is. Really good pizza. It's got to be really good pizza. And then I really like broccoli.
Pizza, bacon, and broccoli.
I really like broccoli.
You're allowed. You're allowed. All right, so desert island dinner the night before you're rescued.
I would do a steak frites. I would do a really good steak.
In your post-vegetarian life.
Yeah, I would do a ribeye.
A bone-in ribeye.
Yeah, bone-in ribeye, yeah.
I like that.
And some really good, you know, crispy French fries.
Ooh, I like the way you're thinking.
Yeah, that's like what I would do. Thinking. And then maybe a side of broccoli.
And if one chef could be helicoptered in for this desert island meal, who would it be? Like, are you attached to any given chef?
I'm not. And I have to say, interestingly, and I eat out a lot when I'm in New York. I eat out a lot. Upstate, not so much. There's a couple of restaurants I love. You know, New World Bistro, Rick Orlando's restaurant up there, and a couple of others. But 9 times out of 10, when I'm cooking dinner at home, Jimmy and I always say, you know what? We couldn't get a better dinner out.
And you cook together well.
Yeah, we cook together well.
Because my wife and I can't really cook together.
Really? Why?
No, I don't know. We just like, it becomes an ego thing.
Does Vicky cook? Is she
good
cook?
Yeah, she's a really good pastry chef, and I'm not. But it sounds like you and Jimmy can work really well together.
Yeah, we cook really well together. Although, you know, I have a way with vegetables. I don't know what it is. I make really amazing vegetables and salads. Simple salad dressing, but I don't know. Everybody's always asking me the recipe. It's not a big deal. It's just good olive oil. I like white balsamic and Dijon mustard. You know, that's my base. And then I play with other things, whatever I put it. But he doesn't do it right. He can't figure that out.
Salad dressing's a tricky thing. So desert island dinner companions.
A lot of my friends are comedians.
All right. That's okay.
So, you know, I think the best dinner company is funny company.
Okay.
You know, I like to laugh. And I think because I'm a comedian, I don't laugh that much at real comedy on TV or sitcoms or even comedians. I laugh at like real life.
In dinner.
Yeah, at dinner.
All right, so who would the comedians be?
It would probably be Joy Behar, who's my very closest friend. It would be Jimmy, my husband. It would be my friend Larry Amoros, who's the funniest person I know. He's a comedy writer. Gilbert Gottfried. Because nobody makes me laugh more than Gilbert. He just looks at me and I laugh. I don't think he's a foodie, though, Gilbert.
Larry, maybe?
Larry David, oh, yeah. Larry David, absolutely. I enjoy dining with Larry David. We've spent a lot of meals together because we're on the set a lot together.
And does he like to eat?
Yes, he likes to eat, but he's not a big... He's
not a foodie.
No, he's a skinny little thing, you know. But he likes to eat. I enjoy eating with people who like to eat and like to drink. You know, you want a nice bottle of wine at dinner.
Yep, I'm with you. So what's next in your work life and your food life?
Well, my food life, I am going to plant a garden at my house this summer, which we've been in the house for 4 years, but we've been doing a lot of, this weekend actually, we're going to do some landscaping. So that's, I love the idea of picking my vegetables and cooking them. As a matter of fact, the people next door just sold their house, and the buyers were people who were making an organic farm next door. So I'm looking forward to just running across the lane and grabbing my vegetables. Work life, I've been doing just tons of guest stars. Just yesterday, I was nominated for a Critics' Choice Award for Best Guest Star for my guest star I did in Broad City on Comedy Central.
Oh, I hear Broad City is awesome.
It's hilarious. Alana Glazer and Abby Jacobson, they're brilliant. They're like the little me and Joy. I feel like they're little. So I play Alana's mother on the show, hopefully next season as well. Last night, I was on Law & Order SVU. I've been doing a recurring lawyer role on that. So a lot of, you know, acting jobs. I'd like more of those. Stand up, just tons of stand up.
You're working.
I'm always working.
You're always working.
I'm always
which is
working.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you know, I have to ask you to pretend I'm Jeff Garlin.
Yeah.
And just go off on me for like 10 seconds.
You're a fat fuck, Ed Levine.
That's perfect. Thank you so much, Susie Espin. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure is all mine, Ed.
It was great.